one was killed, and a female detainee was sexually assaulted by three of her MI interrogators. The Faye Jones report notes that CPT Wood should have been aware of the potential for detainee abuse at Abu Ghraib, given her knowledge of prior abuses by her MI soldiers. However, Wood received a Bronze Star for valor after her duty in Afghanistan, and another Bronze Star, along with a promotion following revelation of the abuses in Abu Ghraib. If such leadership wins high distinctions, what then constitutes bad leadership in that military corps? Failures of bystander intervention by numerous observers of the abuse on Tier 1A helped to perpetuate that abuse. Among those who were identified as witnessing abuses and doing nothing about them were the following. Soldier 15, MI interrogator, and Soldier 22, who also heard MPs say they were using detainees as practice dummies by striking them unconscious. Soldier 24, intelligence analyst, present during abuse of detainees in many photographs. Soldier 25, interrogator, who thought it was funny when dog handlers scared detainees into running into their cells as dogs attacked. She was also present when a pyramid of naked prisoners was formed. Soldier 20, medic, who witnessed prisoner abuse and saw photos of the naked pyramid. Soldier 01, medic. She also saw the human pyramid when called to provide medical treatment. Also included are those mentioned earlier who watched the dog attacks and never challenged the dog handlers or reported the abuses. Not content to observe in silence, many others eagerly joined the fray. One Army analyst, Soldier 10, threw water on three naked detainees. One interrogator, Soldier 19, actively participated in the abuse of three detainees depicted in the photographs, threw foam balls at their genitals, poured water over them, and gave instructions to MPs to abuse a detainee who was later found naked and hooded on the floor, whimpering. The Faye Jones report identifies another personally involved interrogator. Soldier 29 saw Grainer slap a detainee. She saw a computer screensaver with the image of seven naked detainees in a human pyramid. She saw the photos being taken. She knew that MPs gave a detainee a cold shower, made him roll in dirt, and then forced him to stand in the cold until he was dry. She stripped a prisoner naked and walked him outside in the cold on a winter night. Most tellingly, in support of Chip Frederick's defense, this female interrogator is charged with giving MPs instructions to mistreat and abuse detainees. It was proven that she told that to SSG Frederick when detainees had not cooperated in an interrogation, which appeared to result in their subsequent abuse, according to Faye and Jones. This thorough investigation by two Army generals should lay to rest any claims that the MPs on the night shift of Tier 1A abused and tortured the prisoners solely out of their personally deviant motivations or sadistic impulses. Instead, the picture that is emerging is one of complex multiple causality. Many other soldiers and civilians are identified and implicated in various ways in the torture and abuse process. Some were perpetrators, some facilitators, and some observers who failed to report abuses. In addition, we see that a legion of officers is also fingered as responsible for these abuses by their failures of leadership and by creating the chaotic, impossible situation in which Chip Frederick and those serving under him found themselves enmeshed. However, General Sanchez was not directly implicated in any wrongdoing by this investigation. Yet he was not entirely off the hook, according to General Paul J. Kern, who told reporters, "We did not find General Sanchez culpable, but we found him responsible for what did or did not happen." Now, that is really elegant wordplay. General Sanchez is not culpable, but merely responsible for everything. We will not be as charitable to this officer. Next, we turn to a special investigation ordered by Rumsfeld and headed not by another general, but by former Defense Secretary James Schlesinger. This committee did not conduct new, independent investigations, Rather, they interviewed top military and Pentagon leaders, and their report offers us many important features for the case we are building. The Schlesinger Report identifies culpability. This is the final investigative report we will present. It offers valuable evidence to our case for the situational and systemic influences contributing to the abuses at Abu Ghraib. Of special interest are its specification of many shortfalls in the detention center operation, its pointing out leadership and command culpabilities, and its revelation of the cover-up of the photos of abuse by the military after Joe Darby took the photo CD to a military criminal investigator. What struck me as most unexpected, and what was much appreciated in this report, is the section devoted to detailing the relevance of social-psychological research to understanding the abuses at Abu Ghraib. Unfortunately, it is tucked away in an appendix, G, and therefore likely not to be widely read. This addendum to the Schlesinger Report also presents the apparent parallels between the Abu Ghraib situation and the abuses that occurred during the Stanford prison experiment. Widespread military abuses. First, the report notes the widespread nature of abuse across all U.S. military facilities. The term torture is never used. At that time, November 2004, there were 300 incidents of alleged detainee abuse in joint operation areas, with 66 established as abuse by forces at Guantanamo and in Afghanistan, and 55 more in Iraq. A third of these incidents were related to interrogation, and at least 5 deaths of detainees were reported as having happened during interrogation. 24 additional cases of detainee deaths were still under investigation at that time. This grim account seems to fill up the vacuum that Fay and Jones referred to in their report about the abuses on Tier 1A. Albeit they were the most visible instance of the abuses perpetrated by soldiers, they may have been less horrible than the murders and mayhem in other military detention facilities that we will visit later. Major problem areas and exacerbating conditions. The Schlesinger Report identified 5 areas as major problems that fed into the context of the abuses. They are inadequate mission-specific training of MPs and MI soldiers, equipment and resources shortfalls, pressure on interrogators to produce actionable intelligence, with inexperienced, untrained personnel and detainees who were in custody for as long as 90 days before being interrogated. Leadership that was weak, inexperienced, and operating within a confused, overly complex structure. The CIA operating under its own rules without accountability to anyone in the military command structure. The report also specifies a number of prevailing conditions that exacerbated the difficult task facing the soldiers in the Abu Ghraib prison, notably those on the hard site in Tier 1A. It lists the following conditions that impacted the MPs and MIs on that tier. The fear besetting MPs given that the facility was under frequent hostile fire from mortar and rocket-propelled grenades. Detainee escape attempts were numerous. Several riots in the prison. MI and MP seriously under-resourced. MI and MP lack of unit cohesion and mid-level leadership. Reserve MI and MP units had lost senior NCOs and other personnel through rotation back to the United States and or reassignment. 372nd MP soldiers were not trained for prison guard duty. Thinly stretched in dealing with the large number of detainees. 800th MP was among the lowest units in priority and did not have the capability to overcome the shortfalls it confronted. Lack of discipline and standards of behavior were not established or enforced. No clear delineation of responsibility between commands and little coordination. Lax and dysfunctional command structure. Weak and ineffective leaders. Top leaders failed to ensure that subordinates were properly trained and supervised. Some medical personnel failed to report detainee abuses that they had witnessed and provided tacit approval as bystanders. Secretary Rumsfeld publicly declared he directed one detainee be held secretly at the request of the Director of Central Intelligence. That action provided a model of deception at the highest levels of command, which was emulated in various ways by others in command at Abu Ghraib. What we have here is again a failure of leadership. Again and again, this report makes evident the total failure of leadership at every level and its contribution to the abuses by the MPs on the notorious night shift. The aberrant behavior on the night shift in cell block 1 at Abu Ghraib would have been avoided with proper training, leadership, and oversight. These abuses represent deviant behavior and a failure of leadership and discipline. There were other abuses not photographed during interrogation sessions and abuses during interrogation sessions elsewhere than Abu Ghraib. Still, the abuses were not just the failure of some individuals to follow known standards, and they are more than the failure of a few leaders to enforce proper discipline. There is both institutional and personal responsibility at higher levels. At the tactical level, we concur with the Jones-Fay investigation's conclusion that military intelligence personnel share responsibility for the abuses at Abu Ghraib. The unclear command structure at Abu Ghraib was further exacerbated by the confused relationships up the chain. The unclear chain of command established by CJTF-7, combined with the poor leadership and lack of supervision, contributed to the atmosphere at Abu Ghraib that allowed the abuses to take place. At the leadership level, there was friction and a lack of communication between the 800th MP Brigade and the 205th MI Brigade through the summer and fall of 2003. There was a lack of discipline, and standards of behavior were not established or enforced. A lax and dysfunctional command climate took hold. There were serious lapses of leadership in both units from junior non-commissioned officers to battalion and brigade levels. The commanders at both brigades knew, or should have known, abuses were taking place, and taken measures to prevent them. By not communicating standards, policies, and plans to soldiers, their leaders conveyed a tacit approval of abusive behaviors toward prisoners. Weak and ineffectual leadership of the commanding general of the 800th MP Brigade and the commanding officer of the 205 MI Brigade allowed the abuses at Abu Ghraib. We concur with the Jones finding that LTG Sanchez and MG Wojtkowski failed to ensure proper staff oversight of detention and interrogation operations. The independent panel finds BG Karpinski's leadership failures helped set the conditions at the prison which led to the abuses. Cover-up of the abuse photos. The Schlesinger panel also mentions in passing how the military responded to the revelation of abuse and torture in the trophy photos. Interestingly, the committee uses language that takes all the officials off the hook for negligence and malfeasance. There was an attempt at a cover-up by downplaying the meaning and significance of this damning photographic evidence of torture and abuse. The officials who saw the photos on January 14, 2004, not realizing their likely significance, did not recommend the photos be shown to more senior officials. Based on the interim report to CJTF-7 and CENTCOM commanders in mid-March 2004, their impact was not appreciated by these officers or their staff officers, as indicated by the failure to transmit them in a timely fashion to more senior officials. Again, the reluctance to move bad news up the chain of command was a factor impeding notification of the Secretary of Defense. General Richard Myers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, tried to delay public showing of the photos by CBS television in April 2004, so he must have realized that they had some likely significance. Nevertheless, as I have mentioned previously, this top general felt free to say publicly that he knew these events were not systematic, but rather were due to the criminal actions of a few bad apples. The Social Psychology of Inhumane Treatment of Others. Among the dozen investigations of abuses in military detention facilities, the Schlesinger Report is unique in offering a detailed consideration of the ethical issues involved and in summarizing the psychological stressors and the situational forces operating in Abu Ghraib prison. Unfortunately, both of these special features are tucked away at the end of the report in Appendices H, Ethics, and G, Stressors and Social Psychology, when they should have been highlighted. Of personal relevance is the committee's identification of parallels between the Stanford prison experiment and the Abu Ghraib abuses. Let's briefly review the main points raised in this section of the Schlesinger Report. The potential for abusive treatment of detainees during the global war on terrorism was entirely predictable based on a fundamental understanding of the principle of social psychology principles, coupled with an awareness of numerous known environmental risk factors. Findings from the field of social psychology suggest that the conditions of war and the dynamics of detainee operations carry inherent risks for human mistreatment, and therefore must be approached with great caution and careful planning and training. However, the report noted that most military leaders are unacquainted with such important risk factors. In addition, the Schlesinger Report made clear that understanding the psychological foundations of the abusive behaviors does not excuse the perpetrators. As I have stated previously throughout this book, such conditions neither excuse nor absolve the individuals who engaged in deliberate immoral or illegal behaviors, even though certain conditions heightened the possibility of abusive treatment. The lessons of the Stanford prison experiment. The Schlesinger Report boldly proclaimed that the landmark Stanford study provides a cautionary tale for all military detention operations. In contrasting the Abu Ghraib environment to the relatively benign environment of the Stanford prison experiment, the report makes it evident that, in military detention operations, soldiers work under stressful combat conditions that are far from benign. The implication is that those combat conditions might be expected to generate even more extreme abuses of power by military police than we observed in our mock prison experiment. The Schlesinger Report continues to explore the central issue we've been dealing with throughout our Lucifer Effect journey. Psychologists have attempted to understand how and why individuals and groups who usually act humanely can sometimes act otherwise in certain circumstances. Among the concepts the report outlined to help explain why abusive behaviors occur among ordinarily humane individuals are the following: de-individuation, dehumanization, enemy image, groupthink, moral disengagement, social facilitation, and other environmental factors. One such environmental factor singled out was the widespread practice of stripping detainees. The removal of clothing as an interrogation technique evolved into something much broader, resulting in the practice of groups of detainees being kept naked for extended periods of time at Abu Ghraib. In its very sensitive analysis of why this practice of enforced nakedness played a causal role in the abuses of detainees by MPs and others in Tier 1A, the Schlesinger Report noted that the initial intention was to make detainees feel more vulnerable and to become more compliant with interrogators. However, it describes how this tactic eventually fostered dehumanizing conditions on that tier. Over time, this practice is likely to have had a psychological impact on guards and interrogators as well. The wearing of clothes is an inherently social practice, and therefore the stripping away of clothing may have had the unintended consequence of dehumanizing detainees in the eyes of those who interacted with them. Dehumanization lowers moral and cultural barriers that usually preclude the abusive treatment of others. Common to these investigative reports, and the others not included here, are two key elements. They specify a variety of situational and environmental contributions to the abuses at Abu Ghraib. They also identify many systemic and structural contributors to those abuses. However, because top military brass or the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, commissioned them, the authors of these dozen reports stop short of attributing blame to higher levels in the chain of command. For a clearer focus on that bigger picture, we leave this evidentiary foundation for our case and turn next to a recent report from Human Rights Watch, the largest such organization that works to defend human rights worldwide. See www.hrw.org. Human Rights Watch Report. Getting Away with Torture? Getting Away with Torture is the provocative title of the Human Rights Watch, HRW, Report, April 2005, which stresses the need for a truly independent investigation of the many abuses, tortures, and murders of prisoners by U.S. military and civilian personnel. It calls for an investigation of all those who were the architects of such policies that have led to wanton violations of human rights. We can think of the torture dungeon at Abu Ghraib and similar facilities at Gitmo and other military prisons in Afghanistan and Iraq as having been designed by their senior architects, Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Tenet. Next came the justifiers, the lawyers who came up with new language and concepts that legalized torture in new ways and means. The president's legal counselors, Alberto Gonzalez, John Yoo, Jay Bybee, William Taft, and John Ashcroft. The foremen on the torture construction job were the military leaders, such as Generals Miller, Sanchez, Karpinski, and their underlings. Finally came the technicians, the grunts in charge of carrying out the daily labor of coercive interrogation, abuse, and torture. The soldiers in military intelligence, CIA operatives, civilian contract and military interrogators, translators, medics, and military police, including Chip Frederick and his night shift buddies. Shortly after the photographic revelations of abuses at Abu Ghraib, President Bush vowed that the wrongdoers will be brought to justice. However, the HRW report points out that only the lowly MPs were brought to justice, and that none of those who created the policies and provided the ideology and permission for those abuses to take place ever were. In the intervening months, the HRW report concludes, "It has become clear that torture and abuse have taken place not solely at Abu Ghraib, but rather in dozens of detention facilities worldwide, that in many cases the abuse resulted in death or severe trauma, and that a good number of the victims were civilians with no connection to Al-Qaeda or terrorism. There is also evidence of abuse at controlled, secret locations abroad, and of authorities sending suspects to third-country dungeons around the world where torture was likely to occur. To date, however, the only wrongdoers being brought to justice are those at the bottom of the chain of command. The evidence demands more. Yet a wall of impunity surrounds the architects of the policies responsible for the larger pattern of abuses. As this report shows, evidence is mounting that high-ranking civilian and military leaders, including Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, former CIA Director George Tenet, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, formerly the top commander in Iraq, and Major General Jeffrey Miller, former commander of the prison camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, made decisions and issued policies that facilitated serious and widespread violations of the law. The circumstances strongly suggest that they either knew or should have known that such violations took place because of their actions. There is also mounting data that, when presented with evidence that abuse was in fact taking place, they failed to act to stem the abuse. The coercive methods approved by senior officials and widely employed over the last 3 years include tactics that the United States has repeatedly condemned as barbarity and torture when practiced by others. Even the Army Field Manual condemns some of these methods as torture. Although much relevant evidence remains secret, a series of revelations over the past 12 months brought together here already makes a compelling case for a thorough, genuinely independent investigation of what top officials did, what they knew, and how they responded when they became aware of the widespread nature of the abuses. As upsetting as were the images of abuse and torture by the Tier 1A night shift MPs, they pale in comparison to the many murders of detainees by soldiers, CIA, and other civilian personnel. If the United States is to wipe out the stain of Abu Ghraib, it needs to investigate those at the top who ordered or condoned abuse and come clean on what the president has authorized, said Reed Brody, special counsel for Human Rights Watch. He adds that Washington must repudiate once and for all the mistreatment of detainees in the name of the war on terror. Many abusers, few punished. Officers get free ride. Let's set the record straight on the extent of abuses of detainees in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. A recent Army statement indicates that more than 600 accusations of abuse of detainees have been reported since October 2001. Of those, 190 have never been investigated, or there is no known investigation of them, the ghost abusers. At least 410 other accusations have been investigated with the following consequences. 150 faced disciplinary action, 79 were court-martialed, 54 were found guilty, 10 were sentenced to more than 1 year in prison, 30 were sentenced to less than 1 year, 14 got no prison time, 10 were acquitted, 15 cases are still pending or charges were dropped, 71 were administratively disciplined or non-judicially disciplined. If one does the addition, that leaves at least 260 investigations closed or whose ongoing status was unclear as of April 2006, the time the report was published. One of the dog handlers, Sergeant Michael Smith, was sentenced to 6 months in prison for using his unmuzzled dog to torment prisoners. He maintained that he had been following orders to soften up prisoners for interrogation. He is also reported to have said that soldiers are not supposed to be soft and cuddly, and he was not that. As of April 10, 2006, there was no evidence that the military has even attempted to prosecute a single officer under the doctrine of command responsibility for personally directed abuses or for those of their subordinates. In the detailed report of all investigated abuses, only 5 officers have been criminally charged, none under the command responsibility doctrine. 1 Army captain was charged with dereliction of duty for the deaths of 2 detainees in Afghanistan. The charges were dropped. A Navy lieutenant was charged with assault and dereliction of duty in the death of a ghost detainee, Manadel Al-Jamadi. He was acquitted. 3 other officers, a lieutenant, a captain, and a major, were convicted at court-martial of detainee abuse, either directly participating in abusing prisoners or ordering their troops to do so. 1 received a sentence of only 45 days in prison, another got 2 months, and the 3rd was discharged with no prison sentence at all. The military command goes soft on its errant officers by using non-judicial hearings and administrative reprimands that are usually meant for minor offenses and carry weak sentences. This is so even in more than 70 cases of serious criminal abuse, including 10 homicides and 20 assault cases. Such leniency extends also to CIA operatives in at least 10 abuse cases and 20 civilian contractors working for the CIA or the military. Thus, it becomes evident that detainee abuse was widespread far beyond Abu Ghraib, and further, that there is a general failure of command responsibility in any of the many cases of abuse and torture. HRW goes up the command chain. After its detailed documentation of the widespread abuses perpetrated by soldiers in MP and MI brigades, the CIA, and civilian contractors serving as interrogators, the HRW goes nearly all the way up the chain of command in its accusation of criminal responsibility for war crimes and torture. While there are obviously steep political obstacles in the way of investigating a sitting defense secretary and other high-ranking officials, the nature of crimes is so serious, and mounting evidence of wrongdoing is now so voluminous, that it would be an abdication of responsibility for the United States not to push this to the next level. Unless those who designed or authorized the illegal policies are held to account, all the protestations of disgust at the Abu Ghraib photos by President George W. Bush and others will be meaningless. If there is no real accountability for these crimes, for years to come, the perpetrators of atrocities around the world will point to their treatment of prisoners to deflect criticism of their own conduct. Indeed, when a government as dominant and influential as the United States openly defies laws against torture, it virtually invites others to do the same. Washington's much-needed credibility as a proponent of human rights was damaged by the torture revelations and will be further damaged if torture continues to be followed by complete impunity for the policymakers. Stripping away immunity for the architects of illegal policy. Both U.S. and international law recognize the principle of command responsibility, or superior responsibility, by which individuals in civilian or military authority may be criminally liable for crimes committed by those under their command. Three elements are required for such liability to be established. First, there must be a clear superior-subordinate relationship. Second, the superior must have known or had reason to know that the subordinate was about to commit a crime or had already committed a crime. Third, the superior must have failed to take necessary and reasonable measures to prevent the crime or to punish the perpetrator. War crimes and torture are punishable under the terms of the War Crimes Act of 1996, the Anti-Torture Act of 1996, and the Uniform Code of Military Justice, UCMJ. Human Rights Watch goes on record arguing that a prima facie case exists that warrants the opening of criminal investigations with respect to four officials: Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, former CIA Director George Tenet, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, and Major General Jeffrey Miller. Here I can only outline some of the justifications for holding each of these officials liable for the acts of torture and abuse committed under their watch. A full description and supporting evidence is provided in the HRW report. On trial, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld told the Senate Armed Services Committee, "These events occurred on my watch. As Secretary of Defense, I am accountable for them. I take full responsibility." HRW asserts that Secretary Rumsfeld should be investigated for war crimes and torture by U.S. troops in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Guantanamo under the doctrine of command responsibility. Secretary Rumsfeld created the conditions for troops to commit war crimes and torture by sidelining and disparaging the Geneva Conventions. He did so by approving interrogation techniques that violated the Geneva Conventions as well as the Convention Against Torture, and by approving the hiding of detainees from the International Committee of the Red Cross. HRW continues, "From the earliest days of the war in Afghanistan, Secretary Rumsfeld was on notice through briefings, ICRC reports, human rights reports, and press accounts that troops were committing war crimes, including acts of torture. However, there is no evidence that he ever exerted his authority and warned that the mistreatment of prisoners must stop. Had he done so, many of the crimes committed by forces could have been avoided. An investigation would also determine whether the illegal interrogation techniques that Secretary Rumsfeld approved for Guantanamo were actually used to inflict inhuman treatment on detainees there before he rescinded his approval to use them without requesting his permission. It would also examine whether Secretary Rumsfeld approved a secret program that encouraged physical coercion and sexual humiliation of Iraqi prisoners, as alleged by the journalist Seymour Hersh. If either were true, Secretary Rumsfeld might also, in addition to command responsibility, incur liability as the instigator of crimes against detainees. Rumsfeld authorized a list of interrogation methods that violated the Geneva Convention and the Convention Against Torture used on detainees at Guantanamo, which then migrated to other military prisons in Afghanistan and Iraq. Among his directives for preparing detainees for interrogation were the following. The use of stress positions, like standing, for a maximum of 4 hours in isolation up to 30 days. The detainee may also have a hood placed over his head during transportation and questioning. Deprivation of light and auditory stimuli. Removal of all comfort items, including religious items. Forced grooming, shaving of facial hair, etc. Removal of clothing. Using detainees' individual phobias, such as fear of dogs, to induce stress. In addition, standard operating procedures advocated exposing detainees to extremes of heat, cold, light, and noise. This Department of Defense was repeatedly warned about torture and abuse of detainees by the International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC, in May and July 2003, prior to the public exposé at Abu Ghraib, and again in February 2004. The ICRC reported on hundreds of allegations of prisoner abuse at a number of military venues, making repeated requests to take immediate steps to correct these abuses. These concerns were ignored, the abuses worsened, and inspections by the ICRC were curtailed. In its February 2004 report, presented confidentially to officials of the coalition forces, the following violations against protected persons deprived of their liberty during their internment by coalition forces, the ICRC highlighted the following. Brutality upon capture and initial custody, sometimes causing death or serious injury. Physical or psychological coercion during interrogation to secure information. Prolonged solitary confinement in cells devoid of light. Excessive and disproportionate use of force resulting in death or injury during the period of internment. The ICRC report concludes with a stern warning that the Secretary of Defense should have heeded, but apparently did not. The practices described in this 24-page report are prohibited under international humanitarian law. They warrant serious attention by CF, correctional facilities. In particular, CF should review their policies and practices, take corrective action, and improve the treatment of prisoners of war and other protected persons under their authority. Amnesty International has also weighed in with its own in-depth report on detention and torture in Iraq. It calls upon the Iraqi, U.S., and U.K. authorities to take urgent, concrete steps to ensure that the fundamental human rights of all detainees in Iraq are respected. In particular, these authorities must urgently put in place adequate safeguards to protect detainees from torture or ill treatment. Mark Danner, a journalism professor at the University of California, Berkeley, reviewed all the relevant documents for his book, Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. Danner concludes from his detailed investigation that when you read the documents, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld was involved very personally in approving procedures that went beyond the line of what is allowed in military law, and for that matter in civilian law, when it comes to what can be done to prisoners. On trial, former CIA Director George Tenet. HRW accuses former CIA Director George Tenet of a variety of violations. Under George Tenet's direction, and reportedly with his specific authorization, the CIA tortured detainees through waterboarding, the near drowning of a suspect, and by withholding their medicines. Other tactics reportedly used by the CIA include feigning suffocation, making prisoners hold stress positions, light and noise bombardment, sleep deprivation, and making detainees believe they are in the hands of foreign governments known to torture routinely. Under Director Tenet, the CIA rendered detainees to other governments, which tortured the detainees. Under Director Tenet's direction, the CIA also put detainees beyond the protection of the law, in secret locations in which they were rendered completely defenseless, with no resource or remedy whatsoever, with no contact with the outside world, and completely at the mercy of their captors. These detainees, in long-term incommunicado detention, have effectively been disappeared. Recall that the Faye Jones investigation concluded that CIA detention and interrogation practices led to a loss of accountability, abuse, reduced interagency cooperation, and an unhealthy mystique that further poisoned the atmosphere at Abu Ghraib. In effect, the CIA operated under its own rules and beyond the law. Under Director Tenet, the CIA also developed the widespread practice of using ghost detainees. How many? We will never know for sure. But General Paul Kern, the senior officer who oversaw the Faye Jones inquiry, told the Senate Armed Services Committee, "The number of ghost detainees is in the dozens, perhaps up to 100. The CIA kept a number of detainees off the books at Abu Ghraib, hiding them from the ICRC. Army Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Jordan, who was second in command of the intelligence gathering effort at Abu Ghraib while the abuse was occurring, told military investigators that other government agencies and a secretive elite task force routinely brought in detainees for a short period of time, and that the detainees were held without internment numbers, with their names kept off the books. Such practices are violations of international law. The Iceman Goeth. The Faye Jones report mentions one of these ghosted cases. In November 2003, an Iraqi detainee by the name of Manadel Al-Jamadi, brought to the prison by Navy SEALs and interrogated by a CIA agent, was never formally registered. Jamadi was tortured to death, but the cause of his death was concealed in a most unusual way. The investigative reporter Jane Mayer has shed light on the sinister role the CIA played in this homicide and its grisly cover-up. Her fascinating account, A Deadly Interrogation, in the New Yorker magazine, November 14, 2005, raises the question, can the CIA legally kill a prisoner? The Al-Jamadi case is especially important for us in our effort to understand the behavioral context at Abu Ghraib in which Chip Frederick and his other rogue soldiers worked. They were enmeshed in an environment where they observed ghost detainees routinely being brutalized, tortured, and some even murdered. They witnessed perpetrators literally getting away with murder. By comparison with what happened to the ghost detainee Manadel Al-Jamadi, the so-called Iceman, what they did to the run-of-the-mill detainees must have seemed much more like just fun and games. They knew him to have been battered, suffocated to death, and then iced away. Al-Jamadi was a so-called high-value target for interrogation because he allegedly supplied explosives to insurgents. A team of Navy SEALs captured him at his home outside Baghdad on November 4, 2003 at 2 a.m. He ended up with a black eye, a cut on his face, and perhaps half a dozen fractured ribs following a violent struggle. The SEALs turned Al-Jamadi over to CIA custody at Abu Ghraib for interrogation, led by Mark Swanner. This CIA operative, accompanied by a translator, took Al-Jamadi into a holding cell in the prison, stripped him naked, and began yelling at him to tell him where the weapons were. According to Mayer's New Yorker story, Swanner told the MPs to take the prisoner to Tier 1 Alpha, into the shower room for interrogation. Two of the MPs were ordered, by this anonymous civilian, to shackle the prisoner to the wall, even though he was by now totally passive. They were told to hang him from his arms in a torture position known as Palestine hanging, first practiced during the Spanish Inquisition when it was known as strapado. After they left the room, one MP recalled, "We heard a lot of screaming. Less than an hour later, Manidel Al-Jamati was dead. Walter Diaz, the MP on guard duty, said that there was no need to hang him up like that, given that he was handcuffed and offered no resistance. When the MPs were told by Swanner to take the dead man down from the wall, blood came gushing out of his nose and mouth as if a faucet had been turned on, Diaz reported. Now the problem for the CIA was what to do with the victim's body. Captain Donald Rees, the MP commander, and Colonel Thomas Pappas, the MI commander, were alerted to this unfortunate incident on their shift. They needn't have worried, because the CIA took matters into its own stealthy hands. Al-Jamati was kept in the shower room until the next morning, packed in ice and bound with clear tape to retard decomposition of the corpse. The next day, a medic inserted an IV into the Iceman's arm and had him carried out of the prison on a stretcher, as if he were alive but merely ill, so as not to upset the other detainees, who were told he had had a heart attack. A local taxi driver carted the corpse away to an unknown destination. All evidence was destroyed, and there was no paper trail because Al-Jamati had never officially been registered. The Navy SEALs were exonerated for their part in manhandling Al-Jamati, the medic was not identified, and several years later, Mark Swanner continues to work for the CIA, with no criminal charge against him. Case almost closed. Among all the other horror images in Corporal Grainer's digital camera were several photos of that very same Iceman that were recorded for posterity. First, there was a photo of an attractive, smiling specialist Sabrina Harmon bending over Al-Jamati's battered body with a thumbs-up sign. Then Grainer got into the mix to add his approving smile to hers before the Iceman melted away. For sure, Chip and the other night shift MPs knew what had just gone down. If such things could happen and be so deftly handled, then the dungeon of Tier 1 Alpha was the romper room where anything went. Had they not taken those photos and had Darby not sounded the alarm, the world might never have learned what had happened in that once secret place. Nevertheless, the CIA continues unshackled in any way by laws that should restrain its agents from torturing and murdering people, even in its global war on terrorism. Ironically, Swanner has admitted that he obtained no useful information from this murdered ghost detainee. This involvement of the CIA in torture is nothing new, and is evident in the analysis by the historian Alfred McCoy in his recent book documenting its role from the Cold War to the Terror War. According to McCoy, the shocking photographs of abuse from Abu Ghraib are nothing new. In his view, if we look closely at these grainy images, we can see the genealogy of CIA torture techniques, from their origins in the 1950s to their present-day perfection. Indeed, the photographs from Iraq illustrate standard interrogation practice inside the global gulag of secret CIA prisons that have operated, on executive authority, since the start of the War on Terror. These photos, and later investigations they prompted, offer telltale signs that the CIA was both the lead agency at Abu Ghraib and the source of systematic tortures practiced in Guantanamo, Afghanistan, and Iraq. In this light, the nine soldiers court-martialed for the abuse at Abu Ghraib were simply following orders. Responsibility for their actions lies much higher up the chain of command. On trial, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez. Like Rumsfeld, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez also loudly acknowledged his responsibility. As senior commander in Iraq, I accept responsibility for what happened at Abu Ghraib. However, such responsibility should bear appropriate consequences and not be employed as photo op public gesturing. Human Rights Watch includes this top commander among the big four who should stand trial for torture and war crimes. Its report states, Lieutenant General Sanchez should be investigated for war crimes and torture, either as a principal or under the doctrine of command responsibility. General Sanchez authorized interrogation methods that violate the Geneva Conventions and the Convention Against Torture. According to Human Rights Watch, he knew or should have known that torture and war crimes were committed by troops under his direct command, but failed to take effective measures to stop these acts. I am putting General Sanchez on trial in this book because of the fact that, in the words of the HRW report, he promulgated interrogation rules and techniques that violated the Geneva Conventions and the Convention Against Torture, and further that he knew or should have known about torture and war crimes committed by troops under his command. Given the lack of actionable intelligence being gathered at Guantanamo Bay Prison despite months of interrogations, there was pressure on everyone to get the goods on the terrorists, and to do so immediately, by all means necessary. Mark Danner reported an email sent by the military intelligence officer Captain William Ponce to his colleagues, urging them to provide an interrogation wish list by mid-August 2003. The captain infused his message with an ominous foreshadowing of what was to come at Abu Ghraib. "The gloves are coming off, gentlemen, regarding these detainees." His message continued, "Colonel Bolts, the second-ranking MI commander in Iraq, has made it clear that we want these individuals broken. Casualties are mounting, and we need to start gathering info to help protect our fellow soldiers from any further attacks." General Jeffrey Miller, then recently put in charge of the detention facilities at Gitmo, headed a visiting team of specialists to Iraq from August to September 2003. His mission was to spread the new Get Tough interrogation policies to Generals Sanchez, Karpinski, and other officers. General Miller put his finger in Sanchez's chest and told him he wanted the information, according to Karpinski. Miller was able to push these other officers around only with obvious support from Rumsfeld and other high-ranking generals, based on his so-called successes at Gitmo.